I was raised as a woman that was going to break barriers. I knew where I wanted to end up, and I knew I have to work twice as hard as the white girl next to me at school. Working hard and putting the hours in, that's what my parents did.
The first black woman on Newsroom.
Yeah, the first minority anchor. What people see on screen is a tiny part of a bigger wheel. You've got 25 women, and I can sit with any one of those 25 women and just sit and chat for hours.
Who do you love the most?
Oh, favourite. If something were to happen to me as a result of my job, I think a lot about the impact it would have on my kids. I had to grieve that part of my career when I decided to have children, because that was a really big thing that I did want to do in my career. I pivoted. I have a column, I'm a columnist in iPaper. I obviously do Loose Women. I do the news. I wrote the book, No Place Like Home. I do a plethora of things in order to keep my brain happy, because the thing I thought I was going to be doing, the thing I thought I was going to achieve, didn't happen because...
To the barrier smashing, ceiling cracking, plate smashing woman that you've become, and as you move into the next chapter for you, managing perimenopause, managing parents, managing kids, managing a career that's amazing and outstanding, but maybe a bit different from the one that you might have thought you were going to have a decade ago, what would you say to yourself?
Keep striving. Keep bashing through doors. Keep achieving. My brain is never satisfied. Do what you're doing, strive for the best, but also look after yourself.
Welcome to Grit and Grace with me, Debbie Wasko. In this series, I'll be chatting to a whole host of incredible guests to discuss the unique challenges, triumphs, and transformative experiences that often define us as women in midlife. Through shared personal stories and advice, we're going to tackle some of the most important and relevant women's issues to date. I see this as more than just a podcast. It's a movement to change the narrative around midlife, so that women see their second act as a time of opportunity, renewal, and excitement.
So join me, Debbie Wasko, on this journey of grit and grace, sponsored by The Better Menopause, science-driven solutions for women in menopause.
I'm delighted to introduce my next guest. She is a highly respected journalist and presenter, known for her work as a news anchor on ITV News and a regular panellist on Loose Women. With a career spanning over two decades, she has broken barriers, becoming the first black woman to present ITV News at 10. Her insightful reporting and engaging presence have made her a trusted voice in British media. Welcome to Grit and Grace, Charlene White. Charlene, hello, thank you for joining us today.
Hello.
Now, you are a great inspiration to many, including me.
Oh, me.
Yes.
Come on.
Talk to me a little bit about the whole thing. What it has been like to be you and to be the first black woman on News at 10, the first so many things. What does that mean? What's it like in actual life?
In actual life, I was raised as a girl / woman that was going to break barriers. That was sort of what my, break through barriers, that's sort of what my mum and my aunt and my dad and stuff, and my uncles, that was the point of them raising me in the way that I did, and the way that they did, sorry, because they wanted the next generation, the first generation to be born here, to really have an impact in the world. My elder cousin Marcus, he read law at Cambridge. He's the first of all of us to be able to go to university and the first to go to Cambridge. And he is an incredible lawyer. I didn't go to Cambridge or Oxbridge, but wanted to become a kick-ass journalist that would hopefully change the world. We are a generation that I think in my family of kids that our parents and our aunts and uncles just wanted to raise kids who were going to have an impact and really leave their imprint in the world. And I guess that's why I am the way I am, really.
What did that mean? So I think about that similar but different. I'm from an immigrant family. My father was the first to go to university, who went to Oxford to do law and successfully managed to bring up a load of us who also went to Oxford. But that change happened within a generation. So in my family, talked about money a lot around the table, and I was surrounded by female entrepreneurs, which is a very grand, they would never have described themselves that way because they were business owners and the businesses were super humble. But reflect a bit on what did that mean in practical terms, both you and I as mothers, what did it mean for you and what should we be doing with our kids?
It's incredible what you talk about. I don't know, I just remember always talking about things around a dinner table. So food at weekends would always be consumed around lots of people. So two working parents, so we weren't able to eat with them every day. One or the other of them would eat with us after school. But at a weekend, you know, be it my aunts or be it grandma's or be it my uncles or everyone would be at our house. But the one big thing that was important for all of them is that if we are sat down to dinner with the adults, then children will sit at dinner with them for the duration of dinner. There is no popping away from the table to do something else or to play games. You sit at the table and you take part in the conversation. So therefore, understanding current affairs was something that I grew up always knowing because they talked about news stories at the table. Understanding the difficulties that they had at work. My mum was a social worker, my aunt was a teacher, my dad a driving instructor. The daily woes of them trying to get through to the end of the day and the difficulties that comes with that, especially being a minority. All of that stuff was discussed at the table. Their favourite writers were discussed at the table. Music was discussed at the table all the time. And so you realise that you take this in almost through osmosis and you learn so much more about the world when you're younger. So things seem, I don't know, shock you less as you get older, because actually you were amongst that when you were younger. They didn't hide things from us, which, you know, was important to them, that we understood our place in the world, what we deserved in the world, how other people may well perceive us, and how other people's perceptions may well cause us to doubt who we are. But it was always about strength and using our power, and those are sort of things that we would discuss at the table.
So grit and grace is the theme of the podcast, and you have both of those in abundance. But the grit to get from there, from the dinner table, to news at 10, and we'll talk about Loose Women separately, how did you keep going, and what sort of prejudice did you face, and how did you deal with that on a daily basis internally and as you?
I'm not sure what it was like with your family growing up, but with mine, my mum and dad never worked one job. They worked 5-6 jobs between them for almost the entire time that I was at school in order for them to pay for me to go to school and to eventually pay for my brother and my sister to go to school as well. You know, my dad would leave out for work at, 5:45 in the morning, and his working day wouldn't finish until 10 o'clock at night. And that was 6 days a week. So in terms of putting in the work in order to be able to achieve the things that you wanted in life, for him, he was putting in the work to make sure that we could achieve the things that he wanted us to, was very much a theme in my life. So I knew where I wanted to end up. And I knew, as my parents had told us multiple times, I have to work twice as hard as the white girl next to me at school. And working one job and only doing one thing, I wasn't raised with. So working multiple jobs in order to get to where I wanted to get to, it was sort of normal for me, because working hard and putting the hours in, that's what my parents did. So I don't think I've ever just worked one job in my life. And even when I started working after uni, I was working and the second job was volunteering. So I was volunteering in community radio stations, helping to train kids. I was going into pupil referral units and doing training with kids in pupil referral units. I was doing all of that stuff because just doing one thing was a bit of a waste of my time, I felt. But in order to have the grit to do that, I just didn't know how to do it any other way, because that's how I was raised.
Do you feel like overachieving and restlessness is nature or nurture? Do you feel like you would have always been like that? I'm asking for a friend this question. And how much of it is just environment necessity, and how much of it do you think is just how you are?
I think some of
not everyone works like that or in that way.
But I think some of it is me, and some of it is how I've seen my parents work. I have a very busy brain. So in all of my school reports, it would always say, Charlene has a short attention span and she gets really excited about stuff at the start of a project. And then her concentration wanes towards the end of a project. So she really needs to...
Do you think we're all ADHD?
I don't know if it's ADHD. I just know that maybe it is, but I know my brain doesn't like just doing one thing. And whereas that was seen as a downside, a negative when I was at school, that same brain function has got to me where I am through work. And yes, I do get excited about projects at the start. And yes, my concentration goes by the end, but I always put that down to, I'm just the ideas person. Someone else will sort of make it happen, but I just come up with the ideas. And I'm still like that, and that's exactly the way I was at school. But it just means that my interest just jumps constantly from one thing to another. And when a project is taking too long, I really have to dig deep to keep the same level of enthusiasm as I had at the start.
That's why you're perfectly suited to your profession. Talking about Loose Women, and you'll love Loose Women, but what was it really like? And the first black woman on Loose Women.
Yeah, the first minority anchor.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
So frame that for us and what that experience was like.
I had petitioned for a very long time to get onto Loose Women, because for me, it was the perfect, it covers the perfect parts of me. I love current affairs, and I love news, like I live and breathe news, but I always believed that messages could be conveyed in more than one way. And for me, Loose Women is a brilliant vehicle for that. And the campaigning and stuff that they do is right up my street. So after years of campaigning and knocking on doors and going for coffees and all of that stuff, it finally worked. And I love being on that show. I think I'm really lucky to be on that show, to work alongside some incredible women. Like, I work with 25 women who were all completely different, from different walks of life, who have been through different experiences in life, who span generations, who span the UK. And I feel really lucky to be a part of that. I mean, what we see, what people see on screen is a tiny part of a bigger wheel. And as you know, I'm like, between me and, say, Janet, there's like 40 years between me and Janet almost, 35 years between us. So if there's something that I'm almost struggling with and I don't really know the answer to, it's being able to sort of ask Janet a question about something. And she, because she's lived a very varied life, she'll have the answer. It's a family, to be perfectly honest.
Who do you love the most?
Oh,
come on.
Favourites. Well, I love Denise, because Denise is like the naughty girl at the back of class, because I'm always very well behaved.
Are you head girl?
I'm probably more like head girl. And then Denise will work really, really hard to bring out the naughty side of Charlene. So she'll do things like, we'll be on set and we could be live on the programme, and she'll just write me little notes saying stuff that I can't say on air or on this podcast, and she'll write me notes. And then as I'm talking, she'll just shift it over to me. I glance at it, and then I have to work really hard not to burst out laughing, not to look shocked, and just keep on going. And she thinks it's the funniest thing in the world.
I love that.
I adore that woman with like every inch of my being.
Talking about those notes, the Denise notes, the irreverent notes on Loose Women, what do they say?
Oh, I really cannot tell you the content of those notes, because I would get sued. You know, I get on with all the women, and Judy and I live quite close to each other, so I see her quite a lot. And we share a trainer, a gym trainer.
What do you do with your trainer?
So we both do it together?
No,
we tend to go one after the other. So we sort of meet, I meet her at the end of hers and at the start of mine. And we do a lot of weight training and stuff, and really enjoying it. And you know, we've both got kids and what have you, and I just adore all of them. You know, Brenda, I mean, honestly, you've got 25 women, and I can sit with any one of those 25 women and just sit and chat for hours, because they're brilliant.
It's a gift.
Yeah.
Talk to me about Charlene in midlife. Are we allowed to say we're in midlife?
Do you know what? Well,
okay,
on my way here,
I love it, but what's the better way to frame it?
Okay,
talk about where you are in your life? You mentioned weight training.
Yeah, I'm weight training because...
Okay, give me that.
That is good for women over 40.
Indeed.
So I do a lot more of that now. I can squat 100 kilograms now.
That's a big number.
It's a big number.
All right.
But I'm very
on
competitive.
Your
on my back.
All right.
But I'm very competitive.
So am I. Let's get it out.
Yeah.
I've got some weight then, so...
So I said to my trainer, I was like, so
what's
who
Judy
squats?
Doing?
I was like, who squats the most out of your clients? And he was like, oh, well, it's Adam. He does about 125. I was like, right, well, we're working towards 126.
That's the number.
But then, you know, it's a lot harder to manage your weight in midlife, I think. All the training that I do now, if I were in my 20s, it would have an impact straight away. And I guess that's the bit I don't mind referring to as midlife, because in midlife, your hormones change and your body reacts in a completely different way to things like exercise. And that's something that I'm learning in my 40s and after having two kids, that actually managing a healthy weight and having a healthier body and a stronger body is a lot more difficult in your 40s than it was in your 20s and 30s.
Do you identify as being in perimenopause? Is that something that you think about or talk about?
I love that. Do you identify?
Do you
identify?
Well, do you? Because,
the tests. I've had my blood tests and stuff. And I know that I am in going through perimenopause. I do know that. On occasion, I mean, I've changed my vitamin intake and stuff over the last year, which has had a massive difference to the way that my body is reacting to the changing in hormone levels and the slow process of that change. So I wake up, you know, sweating a lot less than I did, say, more than a year ago.
What are you taking?
So I now...
What's the cocktail?
When I'm shaking, full of pills, obviously legal vitamins.
Clearly.
Magnesium, probiotics, vitamin D, vitamin B, what else am I taking? Vitamin A, and there's other stuff. I'm missing stuff. Omega 3, and there's one more that I forget.
A lot. And how's your sleep?
Oh my God. I mean, my sleep is beautiful now.
Amazing.
And before I had the tests done to see what I was lacking a year ago, my sleep was awful. I had gone to see a specialist who did all these tests on me, and they put a heart monitor on me, and I wore it for 3 days and three nights, and the heart monitor showed that my heart didn't go into rest and recovery until 4 a.m. And so 4 till 6 was the only time that my body was going into recovery. And then for one of those days, my heart rate didn't drop enough to go into recovery at all. So we then had to have a really long conversation about having to change lifestyle to a point, but also start keeping on top of my vitamins, but to also make sure that I'd start taking magnesium and stuff as well. And I know the magnesium doesn't work for everybody, but it has been the most incredible thing for me, where actually I do go into a deep sleep. And if the kids wake me up in the middle of the night, I'm not tossing and turning, looking at my phone, waiting for my body to go to sleep again. I am able to go off to sleep straight away. And that was part of the issue. And I think the lack of sleep was sending me doolally. It was sending me crazy. But I didn't realise that I wasn't sleeping well.
And at this stage in our lives, have you had to adjust anything else? How do you think about work and ambition and brand busy, which you are and I am? Has that changed?
I was talking to one of the younger members of staff about this just yesterday. And I said to her, look, I think that she can go quite high in the organisation, and I think she's possibly going to be a boss of mine in the future. But I said, look, if you're going to work towards that, put all that hard work in now before you decide to have children, if that's what you're going to do, if that's for you. Do all of that stuff now, because it becomes 10 times harder after you have children. The want and need for more doesn't go, but being able to successfully do it without sending yourself crazy, that will definitely happen, and it's more likely to happen after you've had children. So how I do my career has changed a lot. I don't travel as much, and that's by choice.
But you had to change the work you do to
I had to be okay with that.
What are you not doing?
So I'm not applying for foreign correspondent gigs. I'm not currently trying to get jobs in the States or elsewhere in Europe. I'm not doing as many foreign sends. I am not pushing to be sent to, say, Israel, for instance, to anchor programs. I'm not doing any of that stuff. I had to, what's the correct word? I had to grieve that part of my career when I decided to have children, because that was a really big thing that I did want to do in my career, was, you know, being able to fly to various different foreign destinations on a regular basis and anchor the programs that I do. That's something that, I mean, we do something in journalism called hostile environment training. And I am hostile environment trained. I've not done it for a while, but I am hostile environment trained. So if someone were to shoot you in the chest, for instance, I'd be able to patch that up, save your life and drag you to the nearest A&E, for example. So I am trained in all of that. But then you have children, and it's not the feeling that every parent has when it comes to doing foreign correspondent work, but it's a feeling that I have, that if something were to happen to me as a result of my job, I think a lot about the impact it would have on my kids and my partner. And I don't want to be flying here, there and everywhere. I want to be able to see them and them know when they're going to see me and know that mummy's there every morning. Mummy's there at bedtime for half the week and isn't there for half the week. But I don't want them to have a scattered routine where every couple of weeks I'm flying somewhere else or I'm flying somewhere else. I just don't want that for them as a parent. So I had to let go of that. And I have my kids so much later in life that I think once they are in both of them in their teenage years, I think I probably would have aged out of doing that stuff.
How did you grieve it? Like, what did you do practically?
I pivoted and just found other ways to keep my brain happy. So that's, you know, I have a column. I'm a columnist, an iPaper. I obviously do Loose Women. I do the news. I do like a whole plethora of different things. I wrote the book, No Place Like Home. I do a plethora of things in order to keep my brain happy, because the thing I thought I was going to be doing, the thing I thought I was going to achieve, didn't happen because I became a parent. And so then I had to find other things, and I just pivoted, to be perfectly honest, use that real management speak. But that's what I did. And I worked really hard to be able to figure out the things that I wanted to do that would also make me happy. And I now have a body of work at the moment that does make me happy.
Talk to me about the book. What's the book about and why did you write it?
So No Place Like Home is about what home means to each of us in our hearts. So it isn't always the four walls that we live in. Our hearts.
Welcome to mine.
Yeah, welcome to yours. I mean, I'm happy to call this home if you want to hand this over at any point. Sure. I'm good. But it's also about, so I always say that home for me is two different places. My parents are from Jamaica, so Jamaica is home to me, but I'm raised in London, so London is home to me. So home is two different places. So I talk about my parents building a home here when they moved from Jamaica. My mum went to secondary school here. My dad moved in his late teens and joined the RAF. So I talk about how my family, my grandparents, built a home away from home in a place that didn't always make them feel welcome. So the first couple of chapters is about that. But then the rest of the book is talking about what home means to other people. So I talked to a family who fled Ukraine about why they decided to leave 48 hours after the war started and how they have tried to build a home here whilst keeping aspects of their other home, which doesn't quite exist in the same way anymore, keeping that. I talked to people who served in the armed forces here because they have a really interesting relationship with home, because as a result of the work they do, they may never return to their home. So how can you be okay with that when you're on the front line? And then I talked to a guy, I mean, there's so many stories. I talked to the wonderful Chris, who grew up in the care system here and one of their most notorious children's homes in Halifax. And he talks about what home means to him, even though it was ripped away from him at 13 and he found himself homeless and in the care system. So how does somebody build a home when they didn't have one for so long? And he sort of says that because he had the fundamentals of a normal home until he was 13, he always knew what he was fighting to get back, despite what he went through in care, despite what he went through when he was living on the streets, despite what he went through when he was in the army. He had grown up in a regular household and had a home, so he knew what life could be. And he said for a lot of the boys that he grew up alongside who didn't quite end up in the same direction that he did, he said, because they actually never knew what home was because they'd never been given one. So it's a really, it's a book that's a lot of interviews and a lot of talk about what home means because each one of us thinks about home in a different way. Where's home for you?
Well, I suppose a related question to that for me was going to be about being a well-known black British woman. Where, how does home relate to you? How do you feel about home? Because I feel, coming from an immigrant culture, I feel weirdly not anything sometimes. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
I feel, I'm not terribly British, but I can fake it. I'm too far away from my Eastern European roots now to, like, how does that mean for you? And is there an additional responsibility there, do you feel, to represent and to be heard and I suppose to fight? Like, what does it mean in your world?
I think I'm really lucky because my links to Jamaica are still very fresh. My dad lives there for half the year and lives here for half the year. So if the tickets weren't as expensive as they are, we would fly out to see him every year, but it's very expensive to fly to Jamaica. So we try and do it every other year. I mean, my stepsister is getting married next year and we're all flying out to Jamaica for her wedding because her ties, same as us, her ties to Jamaica are still very strong because my mum and stepdad live there for 6 months out of the year. So I feel like my connections are as strong now as they always have been. And I feel really lucky and blessed in that way. You know, especially, but I am as equally British because I'm born here. And I think for too long, we sort of tell people what it means to be British. And we try to force people to fit into a very small box. And if you don't fit into that very small box about what it is to be British, then you simply aren't British. And that's simply not true. Being British, being British involves so many different factors, and it's about temperament as well. It's about our obsession with apologising for everything. You bump into somebody, you go, "Oh gosh, I'm so sorry," even if it wasn't your fault. You know, all of that stuff is about being British. The funny stuff, it's the, you know, sitting and have a full English breakfast every now and then, that's also very British. But so is me having a Jamaican breakfast and putting British influences in there. It's the, I also apologise for everything and I sit there and go, why am I apologising? That's so not Jamaican. But that's the British part of me, which is fine. And I think, you know, you sort of have people, you know, tends to be racist, tell us that there's only one way to be British, and that hasn't been true for centuries. And yet, it's a drum that they keep on bashing, and it makes those of us who don't fit into that box feel like we don't belong. Whereas being British is like a million different things that are all as equally beautiful as each other, as the other. And when you don't fit into that narrow box, actually, being Black British as I am is a really beautiful place to be because I choose to not have people tell me what I should do in order to be able to be seen as British because I just don't believe in that.
Talk to me about politics because you're not allowed to be political.
I'm not.
Right, so how is that? How is it? But really, I've always sort of wanted to know that, knowing, being privileged enough to know some amazing journalists. How do you deal with it? Because there's you,
yeah,
and there's your responses to the world, and you're extremely motivated by understanding current affairs, otherwise you wouldn't do your job, but you're not allowed to have a view, or at least a public view.
No.
You just get used to
it. I've been a journalist for 25 years now, so I'm well used to having discussions about politics with due impartiality. So I can be a host of Loose Women, but I can't be in the panel of Loose Women because I can't, I have to be politically neutral. And the whole point of being on the panel is that
have a view.
You have a view. So being a host is the only role that I can have on that programme. Look, all my job is my job is never as a journalist to give my personal opinion on things. And I'm well used to that. My job is to give you all the facts and then you make up your mind as to where you sit politically. I would find it very uncomfortable to be on networks where I give my political opinion because it's so far removed from any work I've ever done in my entire career that I would find that very uncomfortable. I think we have incredible laws here and rules and regulations that are put in place by Ofcom, Office for Communications. And I sometimes feel that people don't realise how lucky they are to have those rules and regulations in place. Because what we are able to do as journalists is simply give you the facts. My opinion doesn't matter. It's not my job to sway your opinion by giving my own. That's not my job. And in other countries, say America, for instance, where they are allowed to have political opinions on news programmes, it means that people aren't able to form their own opinions about particular issues in the world. They're basically told somebody's opinion and that's the one that they believe. Impartiality is something that we should be really proud of here. I don't always think that we shout loud enough, as we should do in broadcast media, about how important that is. Because if everybody only ever showed their opinions where journalism and politics were concerned, then we'd live in an almost, we'd live in an even more diverse, even more divisive society than we do now.
Do you shut the door and rant at home in private?
I mean, me, my brother and my sister have a WhatsApp group.
It's very secret.
And it's a very secret WhatsApp group. My sister now lives in the States. Me and my brother are here. We talk multiple times a day. And, you know, we're all raised in the same household. So we all are very up to date with politics. We discuss politics a lot. I will rant and rave about various different things in our WhatsApp group. And we'll have quite in-depth conversations about politics through voice notes, through text messages or what have you. So yes, but that's what we've always done. Like me, the three of us went away to Rotterdam a couple of years ago for my brother's 30th birthday. And we were away for two or three nights, I think. And we would just sit around at dinner and chat, and it would always end up talking about politics. And we don't all sit on the same side of things, but that's the beauty of individuality and also accepting and understanding other people's opinions on things. And we will get into deep debates till that weekend, till the early hours of the morning. And I love that.
Talk a bit about our lives as part of the sandwich generation. So we have our kids, we have our parents. Part of that and part of this stage, which we're not calling midlife, but we're calling something else, our next chapter, we can experience a lot of grief. And I know that's been part of your life, both your life as a younger person and your recent life. Talk about that if you're comfortable and just how that has been for you and what you've done in order to process it, because I think that's something that for many women who are listening is something that they're going through in some shape or form.
Yeah, I think as women, we carry a lot of the load where grief is concerned when it happens within our families. Not to say that men can't be empathetic or what have you, but I think there's something about women where we feel like we need to just make sure everybody else is okay. That the children are okay, that the partners are okay, that the parents are okay. When something bad happens, you sort of go into nurture mode. And that is always the position that I sit on anytime there's loss. And, you know, the wonderful thing about coming from a big family and having a wide circle of friends is that you have a lot of people in your life. But the downside to that is you will end up experiencing a lot of grief through your life because nobody lives forever. I'm always very comfortable talking about grief, and I always put that down to losing my mum at a younger age. So My mum passed when she was 47. I'm 45 this year, so I'm almost at the age that she was when she passed, and I was 21. I think as a result of experiencing that, I was 21, my sister was 16, my brother was 8. And looking after them was like the immediate mode that I went into, because that's how my parents had raised me. Once they knew that my mum was ill, they started giving me a lot more responsibility within the home. I was doing...
Were you living at home?
I was living at home because I had said, I'd agreed quite early on that I wouldn't leave home until my brother was old enough to not need me to be around every day. And I stayed at home for university. I turned down offers for outside of London because I felt it was my responsibility as the eldest daughter to be around should anything happen. They never asked me to, but I understood that my responsibility as the eldest child meant that I couldn't abandon my family. I remember I did a few months working at the New York Post when I was like 19, 20, I think. And I moved to New York and stayed with my god sister and did work experience for ages, for months at the New York Post. It was amazing. And they had wanted me to basically come back and work for them. And I had to make a really difficult decision slash easy decision to turn them down, which just seems, I'm sure to some people, it's like unfathomable. They literally, if the New York Post is offering you a job, you take it. But I couldn't leave my family. And they never asked me to make that decision. I actually made that decision without having a conversation with them, because I just felt if my mum, something happens to my mum and she's no longer around, it's not fair for me to just leave my family and go create a whole life somewhere else. I didn't think that was fair, so I turned that down. And I think that nurture, that idea of making sure that everybody is okay all the time when there's grief, that was set in stone from when my parents told me that my mum had cancer when I was 16. So I literally don't know any other way to be. And my friends know that. So, you know, when my best friend passed 7 weeks ago, there were lots of my other best mates sort of sending me messages, calling, going, we know what you do in this situation. You go into looking after everybody else mode. We know that's what you do, but you just have to make sure that you let us in and you let us help you. And I know that you're going to say, it's fine, it's fine, it's fine, but it's not. So you need to let us in. But then I revert to type. I'm like, I'm fine. I'll be fine. But they've been amazing with calling, messaging, meeting me for lunches or what have you, just to check that I'm okay. And I feel really blessed to have these people in my life that know me incredibly well and know that I'll go straight into, I just need to make sure that everybody else is okay. But it's really lovely to have amazing women in my life that know that I do that and will just keep calling my phone and making sure that I'm all right and that I'm looking after myself.
And are you looking after yourself?
I think I am now. I think I needed to get his funeral done. And I needed, he was a big supporter and advocate and campaigner for Sarcoma UK, because sarcoma was the cancer that he had. And they had their fundraising ball last weekend. And I, for the last few years, have volunteered my time to host their ball so they can raise as much money as possible, because it's a very rare cancer. So I also need to get that done. And it's been amazing. I think that had been in my head a lot more than I realised, I think. And it was as emotional doing that, I think, as it was doing his funeral, just because, you know, there was a keynote speaker talking about the impact it had on her family when she lost her dad. There were pictures of Daryl up on the screen, because those that they'd lost over the past year from the charity were up on the screen. I mean, it's horrendous. I literally did a lot of crying my way through it whilst drinking a lot of champagne to sort of numb the pain, which I also know isn't the right thing to do, by the way. But then I just needed to get that done, because then that was the last really big emotional thing I had to do for him. So now that that's done, it was almost like a caterpillar coming out of a chrysalis and being a butterfly. It's like, I just need to get that done. And now I feel like I can work on me. So making sure I'm back in the gym, going back to eating properly, not eating my feelings as I have been doing the last 6 weeks. And now that that's done, I can concentrate on me now. But I know that about myself because I've dealt with grief multiple times since I was 21 years old. And I know what I have to do in order to be able to successfully deal and recover from grief and learn to live alongside it again.
Does it all come back up?
Oh,
everything.
Gosh, I mean, you know, Daryl was my best mate. Like, we grew up together. You know, he's been my mate since I was, since we were 16 years old. And I went back into, you know, having issues with God again, being really angry with God again. I even said to the Reverend at his service, who gave a really incredible sermon, and she did it in a way that I've not really heard done before. And I said to her afterwards, I was like, as someone that's currently really angry with God, with the same level of anger that I had when I lost my mum, I just sort of had to thank her for the sermon. And I said, you know, it made me feel like that anger won't last as long as it did last time round. But it will take a few weeks until I go back into church again, because, and maybe a few months until I go back into church again, because I'm really angry. And so all of that anger and feeling of unfairness all came back again. And it comes, you know, and I just remember repeatedly at the funeral just sort of saying, why is it that the good ones get taken and the really shit ones get to still walk the earth? It doesn't make sense to me. But I know that that's a process that I have to go through with grief because I've done it. And it was a big one at 21. And when you go through a big one at 21, you recognise the steps that you have to go through. And so I know that these are the steps that I have to go through, but it will just take a while.
Do you box?
I used to.
You should. Yeah. I recommend it. For grief and anger, yeah. Really. I think it's really important to hit things.
It's funny that you say that on, was it the night? So Dara passed in the early hours of the morning, and I then spent the day with his wife, kids, one of whom is my goddaughter, and her parents. And we just spent the day together. We were pottering together. I was helping with a little bit of homework. We had a bit of a cry. We watched the sun go down. We did, you know, drank glasses of champagne. We toasted to him. We shared memories. Did that all day. But the kids were just obviously really angry. So his wife, Amy, remembered that he had one of those big boxing things. And she was like, right, we're going to get it out the garage. We're going to put it together and the kids can just smash it. So filled it with all the water, filled it with lots of water using the hose, put it together, and the kids just hit it and hit it and hit it just so they could physically get that anger out. And then it started hurting their hands. So then she said, we'll smash plates. We're going to smash plates. That's what we're going to do. So we went inside. We got the dinner plates. And then the kids were a little bit, they sort of went like Can that. I? And I was like, no, you just do it with like as much power and anger that you can muster. Just smash those plates. So then when they realised that they were allowed to, and then they started smashing and they smashed and they smashed. And then the tears came. But they just needed, as you say, you physically have got to get it out. And that worked phenomenally well. And that's what we did on the day that he died.
Charlene, what would you say, what words of wisdom would you offer up to 9-year-old Charlene or 21-year-old Charlene?
Well, at 9 years old, I didn't know what was coming. So life was very different. But to 9-year-old Charlene, as tough as life may have seemed at primary school at that point, just to say that, you know, you'll be all right. It'll be fine. And whatever comes in the future, you will also be fine with that too. Just almost like lean into it. You'll be fine. 21-year-old Charlene, I think I was so used to being in the process of looking out for my dad to look after the family and stuff. I think I would say to 21-year-old Charlene to just take time. Like, I went back to work, I think it was like a week after my mum's funeral. I'd been off for a while by that point, but I went back a week. I definitely should have taken off longer, but I just kind of wanted to get back into the routine of things. I think I should have gone on holiday at that point with my dad and the kids. I think we should have all just gone away for 2 weeks. I think that's what we should have done, rather than going straight into normal life again. So for 21-year-old Charlene, I'd probably say that it's okay to just take time. Just to take time. That's probably what I would say to myself at 21.
And to the barrier smashing, ceiling cracking, plate smashing woman that you've become, what next? And what reflections on what next? And as you move into the next chapter for you, sleeping better, managing perimenopause, managing parents, managing kids, managing a career that's amazing and outstanding, but maybe a bit different from the one that you might have thought you were going to have a decade ago. What would you say to yourself?
Oh, gosh, what would I say to myself now? Keep striving. Keep bashing through doors. Keep achieving. My brain is never satisfied. So when people sort of say, you know, what's next? Well, like 3 years ago, I didn't know I was going to write a book. 5 years ago, I didn't know I was going to end up on Loose Women. Things, I work towards things. When I come up with an idea for something, I work very hard towards it. So my advice to myself would never to be slow down, because I just don't think I can. But it would be do what you're doing, strive for the best, but also look after yourself.
There we go. Charlene, thank you. Thank you for joining me for Grit and Grace, both of which you have in abundance. I've loved it.
Thank you, Debbie.
Thank you so much for listening today. And thanks to our sponsor, The Better Menopause. For more content like this, don't forget to subscribe to our YouTube channel or follow us on socials. See you next time as I'm joined by more incredible guests here on Grit and Grace with me, Debbie Wascoe.